I think it would be amusing and perhaps worthwhile to explain a little bit about how we got started. It actually was a while ago. It actually started as a dare, I would say, from one of the collaborators to the rest. Basically, the dare was that, you know, claim. There is no seesaw mechanism in string theory. Prove me wrong. Right? So some of us were kind of shaking our heads and rolling our eyes. We thought, well, you know, isn't this true about string lore, that anything can be found in string theory? So surely 20 minutes on spires will be enough time to find an extant example of a concrete seesaw mechanism from a real string model. And it turned out that wasn't the case. Was on. I mean, I don't know, maybe somebody can fix this while I tell the story. Anyway, so actually, as it turned out, let's pause. Okay, well, I'm pretty soon I need my talk on that stuff. But anyway, the upshot of all this was that we were kind of surprised to find that while there are a large number of models out there that are string inspired, and that takes some or a large part of what they do from what we know from our working with string theory, there are very few cases in which someone tried to study neutrino masses in their own right from an explicit top-down string model. In fact, you can count them on one hand. And perhaps in some part that's because, as I'm going to explain, it's a difficult problem. And when people were trying to do this in earnest, a while ago, it wasn't really clear we needed to worry about neutrino masses at all. And now that they seem to very much be a part of our world, the neutrino community and the string community have moved very far apart in some ways. So it's time to readdress this. So that's what we set out to do. I'm not really sure. This thing has frozen up my whole computer. Yeah, it's working, but I can't make it do anything else. So let's see. There we go. So there's something wrong, but I don't know what it is. Let's try this again. Okay. All right. Well, good enough. I guess we're going. We're on. All right. Show must go on. So. All right, so this is what I was trying to get at. Why is this hard? Okay, so let me tell you about the work that we did and why it was hard for us. So to begin with, you have to start from a particular, if you want to do a top-down model, you have to start from a concrete location. So we chose something that was quite venerable because we had the technology to do it, which is to say we studied the heterotic E8 cross E8 string. And we did it on a symmetric Z3 orbifold with two Wilson lines, in part, because much work had already been done on this over the last 15 years, so we could stand on their shoulders. Also, in part, of course, because such a construction is guaranteed to give us three generations. Now, as it turns out, for what we're doing, which is a spectrum-driven thing, we don't really need to worry about SUSY breaking or moduli stabilization. But of course, in the back of our mind, we're always assuming that they're stabilized at some values that are reasonable. So that's, of course, a lot to swallow. But once you've done that, you still have to address the issue of flat directions. And that's important because, as we know, in string theory, there are no fundamental mass terms that aren't themselves the Planck mass. I mean, the mass of spectrum, by definition, has no such mass term. So a Majorana mass term, which you need in your supersymmetric superpotential to generate the seesaw mechanism, as we understand it, must come, we presume, from a BEV, a very large one. And so you must worry yourself about D and F flat directions. Okay, I'll talk more about that. So in some sense, and this is not the vacuum selection we're going to hear all about tomorrow and today and yesterday, I'm sure, but in some sense, flavor is the most complicated issue in string theory because it is addressing head-on the most complicated part, which is vacuum selection. But we felt that while that has kind of stopped people in their tracks when it came to quarks and charged leptons, with neutrinos you have a handle. And that means that they're very special. In part, we know that neutrinos may, if they involve a large Majorana mass, may involve a very high energy scale. That Meyer Automata mass operator is a very special beast. It doesn't occur anywhere else in the MSSM plus neutrinos. We want something coupling to itself in the superpotential. And our own past experience seemed to indicate that that was a rare instance. And of course, because they are special, and because at least from the standard model part of the gauge group, they are singlets, perhaps neutrinos are in fact something very exotic. I'm not going to talk much about that option. I'm going to talk about the standard idea that they are just simply singlets with respect to the standard model. Thank you. Sorry about that. All right. So really what we wanted was an existence proof, okay, that you can do this in a real top-down construction. There's no impediment, of course, in your mind. And of course, it's gauge invariant. And there's no reason why there can't be a seesaw. So we went out to look for it. Okay. So just to remind you of what we're after here, this is the seesaw mass matrix. So it involves components of an SU2 left doublet and something which we might call a sterile neutrino. But by that, I mean really that it carries no SU2 left or U1 hypercharge. It's a 2x2 mass matrix. I don't know which button of this turns on the beam. Ah, there we go. So this right here would be present if there was an SU2 triplet. But we're going to be looking for the standard seesaw, which involves both a coupling that comes from the standard trilinear coupling, a Dirac coupling between the right-hand neutrino and two lepton doublets, one of which we'll call an uptype Higgs, and one of which is the lepton doublet, and then this, which is a mass term which we presume to be large, coupling a neutrino, a right-hand neutrino, to its conjugate species, so coupling it to itself, right? So the standard seesaw we're going to be looking for is one in which we do not have these triplets, which in any event don't arise at the affine level one sorts of constructions that we're dealing with. And we're going to be looking for this kind of situation. Now, I'll just jump to the end. We didn't find this, right? We didn't find any working example of this. If we had, we would love to be telling you about the Yukawa textures and about what these masses were and so forth, but it didn't happen. Okay. But anyway, this is the setup that we were looking for. So this is the class of models, so I'll try to explain that we looked at. It's been dubbed the bosonic standard-like class sub A. And the reason that we chose it was in part because while much work was done on this class early on, the sort of subsequent work that we needed was completed by one of our collaborators in the last 3 or 4 years, in fact, as part of his thesis project. So we had a lot to work with already. So what is this class? Well, as I said already, it was a symmetric C3 orbifold. It involves an abelian embedding of the shift embedding here, V, and two Wilson lines, which one set to zero. I've already said this, but I'm going to say it again here, which gave us the three generations. So there's three 16-component vectors that define this. And these have already been classified, those that can give rise to the standard model gauge group in the observable sector. So what our collaborator, Joel Geet, had done was to complete that, finish it for the hidden sector, and work out the twisted sector spectrum, which you need. So the observable sector gauge group, which is one half of the one of these two E8s, will always be, in all these models, SU3 cross SU2, and then a set of U1s, right? And there's always, by construction in this set, one species, so three of the quark doublet. So one species times three for the three generations. So this already is a long way to being realistic. That's why a lot of studies of orbifolds use Z3 either explicitly or implicitly, or thinking about Z3. Of course, there are many that go on to other orbifolds, too. Now, even with this set of restrictions, there are a lot of possibilities. So if you took all the possible embeddings and Wilson lines that were consistent with the underlying string theory, there'd be a lot of possibilities. But that was already shown by these authors some time ago that it can be reduced greatly. But that was only for the observable sector. When you add on the other E8, you explode again the number of possibilities. Okay, so at first, this looks intractable. I mean, this is just the number of models, the number of spectra, number of gauge groups. We're not even talking about Yukawa couplings yet. But it turns out, and this was the work that allowed us to address this problem in the first place, that by being very creative in the way you implement it, especially on a computer, equivalences under lattice translations and Weil reflections, because after all, these are vectors in an E8 cross E8 gauge lattice, root lattice, really, I should say, that there's really only 192 physically distinct cases. And at the time that this work was done, what that meant was that each one of those 192 had the same observable sector gauge group, same Green-Schwarz coefficient for the anomalous U1s. It had the same spectrum and so forth. So it seemed to suggest that they were actually the same model. So a great reduction here from this to this. And of those, as I was trying to say, they fall into classes in which the irreducible representations were the same. So there were only 20 classes. Each one had some multiplicity. Right, so that was encouraging. It suggested we could actually do this exhaustively. So here are the 20 classes, just to orient you to them. The two in red are going to be special, it turns out. And this is all that's allowed. So this is the hidden sector group. Remember, the observable sector is still 3-2, U1 to the fifth. So there's some with SO10, SU5, SU4, and SU3. These are all are such that they could condense. And so these seem like viable models. I give you the scale of the anomalous U1 phi Eliopoulos term. It's some fraction of the Planck mass, so it's a little bit down by about 20%. Turns out that only one of these, or two of these cases, could give you the hypercharge normalization of 5/3. I'm jumping way ahead because I haven't even talked about hypercharge yet, but I just want to point out that it's a characteristic of each of these that they all have the same sort of minimal deviation. There are lots of possible ways you can assign hypercharge. So if you pick the one that deviates the least from what you want, that's always a unique number. So sadly, many of these aren't going to be realistic from that point of view. But it at least suggests, oh, here's the multiplicity too. So there's many in each class. All right. Okay. So here's an example of a model, actually one that we ended up looking at later on. So for what it's worth, these are the three vectors that define it. These are the eight U1s, one of which is anomalous, so its trace is not zero. You can see that some of them mix the U1s from the hidden observable sector, and that's quite common when you have twisted sectors. So you can't really segregate anymore which U1s are the ones from observable and which are from the hidden sector. Here's the anomalous U1. It's about, as I say, it's about 20% of the Planck scale. Okay. So this particular model, which is very representative, has a lot of species, 51. I'm going to just quickly show them in a minute. And this is not uncommon. So this is what Miriam Stedich was talking about, lots of exotics, right? Because anything beyond the 7 or 8 you want from the standard model is by definition exotic. One quark doublet, so that's great. Three candidate, three bars. You only really want two. Lots of things that could be doublets. And one bifundamental, interestingly, between the standard model SU2 and the one that existed in the hidden sector. And 25 species that carried only abelian charges. So any one of those could be your right-handed neutrino. Until you decide what's hypercharged, they're all equally viable. So you've got a big combinatoric problem. And this is, again, why studying flavor in these string models is a challenge. Okay. So, all right. As I said, there's no unique hypercharge assignment. So what you do is you just sort of start with the most selective thing, the quark doublet, you know what that hypercharge needs to be, and you start moving your way down to the right-handed quarks and so forth. And you find, for example, in this case, 18 different ways you could assign, even without the right-hand neutrino. Okay, 18 different ways, none of which gave you the right hypercharge normalization. But there's a lot of combinatorics, is what I'm trying to get at here. And as I'm going to show you, each of these different species can be identified by where they exist in the three. The third complex plane has no Wilson lines, so there's a redundancy. And so you group fields by where they are in that third plane. Okay, so that becomes a family index, which allows you to think that maybe down the road you could do some family, you could study the Yukawa structures by studying that index. As I said, here are the fields. So I'm going to just mention this because I think it's worthwhile for the future. But here's the irreducible representation under the SU3, SU2 of the observable sector. This is the SO10 of the hidden sector. I think this one had SO10. I think it was SU5, I can't remember now. And then here's the SU2. And this is the fixed point location. So these are all untwisted fields, untwisted sector fields. And these are all listed by their twisted sector locations. And so you label them 1, 0, or minus 1. And so this is the point in the first plane and where they are on the third plane, the fifth plane just being its generation. Here are all the U1 charges for the eight U1s. And here's an example of a possible hypercharge combination. So you see the quark doublet's great. We fixed that. We've got the uptype Higgs. We got the uptype right-handed quark, and then there's a bunch of things with zeros here, which could all be right-handed neutrinos. So you don't know which one is which until you look at the Yukawa complex. So it's two pages of this. The reason I point this out is because these kinds of tables take a lot of work to do. It's a very well understood technology, but it hasn't been done, it's hard to get physical review to publish tables and tables of this. But this is the kind of information we'd like to have. Excuse me, for future studies like this. I mean, this kind of database is very useful. We're only beginning to scratch the surface of what we can do with this kind of information. Okay, so as I say, you could just stop there and say, look, I've got right-handed neutrinos. But that's not good enough. You need to know the superpotential. And the superpotential is determined here, as you all know, but it's sometimes worth reiterating, not necessarily just by gauge invariance alone, but by rules that from the 4D point of view, you cannot necessarily identify with just pure gauge invariance. They have more of a discrete quality. Those are the selection rules. And I just point out a couple here, which are easy to state in terms of what I just put on that slide, which is sort of rules that put different fixed point locations together. So not all the Dirac type couplings arise at the leading, which is the trilinear order. That's very important. So that suggests to you that maybe you have a chance to understand hierarchies, but it certainly means you're going to need to turn on vacuum expectation values. Okay, so, all right. As I also said earlier, no fundamental SUSY mass term. So the thing here, where here I and J represent, I guess you, in this case, could be different species or could be different families within a species, you have a matrix of couplings that depend on certain fields, which are going to be singlets of the standard model, that get some kind of vacuum expectation value. So there's a chance that this mass will be somewhere intermediate if the dimensionality is right, but you certainly need to turn on some vacuum values. So if you want that to be a consistent vacuum in the sense that you're really expanding about a true minimum of the potential, then it should preserve supersymmetry at this point. These are VEVs that are going to be at scales much above where you would expect SUSY to be broken. So how do you do that? Well, that's also very well understood. It's merely a matter of putting it into an algorithm. First step always is to find those things which satisfy the D-flatness conditions. You do that by just constructing all the gauge invariant operators in your theory. Up to some, at some point they become redundant, they're just products of lower dimensional ones. But you build them up to whatever order you have the stomach to do, okay? And then flat directions are defined by this relation. You take the Kähler potential, you take one derivative with respect to any one of your fields. Remember, we've got like 60, 70, or 80 of them. And then the combinations of fields defined by this relation satisfy the D-flatness conditions. They will also, so these are combinations of VEVs that you can turn on while preserving the D-flatness. Okay. So what we have required is that these invariants, we'd like to have them attain their VEVs by canceling that phi Eliopoulos term. So we demand that they have a certain overall charge with respect to the anomalous U1. That was the only demand we put onto it. So we built them up to degree 10. The idea being, once you got larger than that, the effective Majorana mass is now going to be quite small relative to what we think we want phenomenologically. But there, other than computer times, there's no reason to stop there. We did. Okay. So you could imagine building linear combinations of these guys, which you might imagine the combinatorics now starts to grow again. So for the since we thought we'd find these things everywhere, we looked under the simplest tree, which is not doing this. We don't really think actually changing this is going to really open up wide ranges of possibilities, but I'll discuss that again near the end. Okay, so how many of these are there? Well, before I discuss that, the next thing you do, right, is you want to marry that to F-flatness. So you just build the entire superpotential. Okay, so you take all the operators allowed by selection rules and gauge invariants. This is how many there are for each of those models at degree 3. You can see it's a lot bigger than the MSSM. And at 4, there were actually none at 5 due to the quirks of the selection rules. 6, 7, 8, we built them out to 9. So out here for this model, this one had no anomalous U1. There are 3 million of them. All right, so that's a big database to mine. Well, we have these all, actually, in the computer. Anytime you want them, we'll mail them to you. OK, so this looks big, but many of them are just products of these smaller guys, which means they're not necessarily carrying any new information for you. But anyway, it's a lot of things to check. And again, these ones in red were the ones that were promising. I'll explain that. So you've got these guys. You've got your D-flatness. Now what you do is for each one of those flat directions, you turn on those VEVs. You go back and look at that superpotential, and you say, all right, if I include all of those operators out to that dimension 9, are there F-term VEVs in the theory? Okay. If so, then you're violating F-flatness. So that's what we did. Now, I think you will have to forgive me, but when you have 3 million, well, 3 million plus terms, and you have 489 flat directions like we have for this one, what we did was we just checked every one of those 3 million terms individually. We say, will this term have a vacuum expectation value if I turn on the VEVs in that flat direction? If so, that one is violated. Throw it out, go to the next one. Okay. Obviously, there could be cancellations. So that would allow you to turn on even more fields. But the more fields you have, the more restrictive this becomes. So it becomes, and it becomes a much more complicated computer challenge. So here's the result of this. So this is how many were up there. If I just ask for if I don't worry about the F flatness. Now, if I ask for F flatness, how many of those B flat directions? There were 1.5 million of them. Now, if I ask, well, how many of them remain flat directions when I just worry about the leading order couplings? Well, there's 16,000. And this 489 is mentioned in the number I just mentioned. That's how many there are when you worry about flatness all the way up to dimension 9. Presumably, it gets smaller and smaller. And at some point, you hope that these things just become redundant multiples of each other, and this thing terminates at some number. OK, so this is the number of flat directions you have to look down. OK, so now we're ready to get started. So for each one of those flat directions, you just ask, do I ever see this coupling? Something? I don't even worry now that it's hypercharged zero. I just want it to have no SU2. Well, actually, we didn't even worry about that at first. We just said, is there any field that couples to itself, and everything else can get a VEV along one of the flat directions? Right? And it happened twice. Okay, so those are the two models. So out of 20 cases, it happened precisely twice. So you're not done, of course. You've got to now ask, well, all right, so now I've identified a candidate right-hand neutrino. Does it ever have this coupling to something that are SU2 doublets? And again, some new sets of fields here. So if you had both of those, you'd be tempted to claim victory, but you wouldn't necessarily be done yet. So as I said, you have to, of course, now assign hypercharges to these guys. That hypercharge has to be such that none of these guys carry it, or else you've just broken it. And you know, if you were really ambitious, you would actually go ahead and try to look for the charge leptons, you try to look for the quarks, and so forth. And you want to make sure that there are no, you know, these mass terms are projecting out the fields you want. So that is where we were heading. So let's look at one of these two. Okay, so it had Majorana couplings at degree 3, so 1 BeV, 2 fields, and degree 9, so 7 BeVs, 2 fields. So let's look at those. So there were, as I said, there were 9 flat directions. Among 6 of them, you could have Majorana couplings of different fields. But it turned out a lot of them were of this form. They were all objects. Here's this thing that's repeated. It's our would-be right-hand neutrino, but it's actually a 10 of the hidden sector SU5. And as we said, we were hoping that this SU5, well, it should confine because it has the right sign beta function coefficient. So the other cases that don't involve these guys all involve some other field that gets a VEV under the SU5. And these fields, 24 and 34, the names are irrelevant. They're just some fields. We're all also SU5. So turned out, in this theory, okay, everything you want to call a neutrino has to be charged under some group you think is getting strong in the hidden sector. Not impossible, but certainly not the sort of kind of clean seesaw we were looking for. But it was worse than that. We couldn't find Dirac coupling. So here's an example of the best we could do. So here's this thing 5, right? Remember, it's a 10 of SU5. It has to couple to these two lepton doublets, which also have this bifundamental in between. This lepton doublet is charged under the hidden sector SU2, so not the SU2 that the quark doublet's charged under. So it's not a particularly realistic model. So there were 642 couplings at degree 6, and 3 of them had this form. So that just, we're trying to show you how rare this is. Okay, neutrinos are just a great handle on reducing the numbers here. So, and as I said, these guys here, these two, didn't have any couplings through degree 6. So this was not going to be a viable sector. So the best you could do is if you could get up to degree 9 in this model, you could perhaps find a couple. We didn't check. There were just too many couplings. But it didn't matter in some sense because we were already looking at neutrino masses that are at this sort of phi Eliopoulos scale, where it's about 0.2. times 10 to the minus 5 EV. So this is already getting a little bit too small to describe you know, the neutrino masses we see. So this model was sick on many different ways. So we went to the other one. So we're now down to just 1 out of 20. So here it is. This is the embedding. There were 42 possible Majorana couplings. They were along 18 different flat directions. Okay. So out of 489. And some of them, actually many of them, had potential direct couplings. So we were pretty excited. So here's an example. So these are the things that get VEVs. Again, the numbers don't matter. These are all singlets, though, of the standard model. So here are two objects. You can see that they basically had the same VEV pattern, except two untwisted fields sneak in here. So you have this replication, right? And there were 3 of the 8 U1 factors still intact. So we had a chance for hypercharge, and this looked good. Okay, we have a Dirac coupling and a Majorana coupling. All right. So here are the fields again. I give them some number labels. So these are lepton doublets. So these are just SU2 doublets. We don't know yet if they're Higgses or you know, the leptons we call leptons. They're just SU2 doublets. So everything with an S is a singlet of standard model. And our ends were our candidate neutrinos. They had Majorana couplings. So you have these two possibilities. they could couple to this pair or this pair. Right? So at this point, you don't know which one to call lepton, Higgs, up type, down type, don't know. Okay, but turns out we could actually do better. We could actually get, we could get both of these. Well, we can go either one of these we chose and say maybe pick hypercharges such that that was the neutrino coupling. Now I can get the charged lepton, and I can even get a new term. So we were pretty excited about this model. It looks like we got everything we want. So here's the identification. You say these three lepton, well, quote, lepton doublets are actually the real lepton and the two Higgses. And these two singlets are the right-handed charged leptons, and the singlet's going to give a mu term. So great. This looks like a very promising model. So here's the hypercharge assignment that made that possible. It's rather complicated, but it's nothing that's so out of the ordinary for these orbifold type models. So it turns out that this thing actually gets the quarks right, too. So we were really excited at this point. The hypercharge normalization is way off, but there's so many exotics in this theory that it's not really clear how gauge coupling unification works anyway. So this wasn't going to be a problem. And our whole spirit is always just keep the eye on the ball of neutrinos. Never worry about anything else. Just put neutrinos first. So it turns out that all the ways you can make a hypercharge with 5/3, because remember, this is one of those cases that you could do it, were broken by this flat direction. Okay, well, all right. It's a little bit worse. The quark doublet doesn't want to couple to anything in the superpotential. So it's in the untwisted sector. And all these doublets that I like are in the twisted sector. So they can't couple at leading order. Right? There's just a rule that forbids that from happening. So the best it could do is order 4. Actually, it didn't happen at order 4. There were no order 5, so you have to go to order 6. And it does couple at order 6, but in this strange sort of R parity violating way, it couples to itself and one of these exotic down type quarks that Paul Langacker talked about. So you do have a coupling. It does involve some things along that flat direction, but it's not our quark coupling. So, you know, here are these species. But again, this wasn't our focus. We were just neutrinos only. So again, we don't worry about this. So did we get the math? Did we get a real math matrix? All right. So let's go back and take a look. Now, what you end up finding, there was this redundancy. There were two different neutrino candidates. They both coupled to the same fields. Which is which? Well, you got to include them all. So you already know this is a bigger neutrino mass system than the standard seesaw, but we pursued it. And it turns out that a lot of the lepton doublets that we don't want get projected out. That's great. But still, even along these flat directions, there's no way to distinguish these two different pairings. Okay, so there's just a redundancy factor 2. It's worse than that, though. Our favorite candidates, 9 and 13, are coupling to other things that have zero hypercharge. Other things that could, I guess, be right-hand neutrinos, of course, they don't have the Dirac couplings, but they're appearing in this mass matrix. So here's our real sector, all right? It's not the minimal seesaw. If we had stopped just by identifying the fields, we would have claimed victory. We would be wrong. There are actually two left-handed doublets, each of which has a neutrino component. There are 4 isoneutrinos, if you will. And then there are the 2 right-handed neutrinos. That's the neutrino system you actually have to consider. And when you do, you find this model fails. Okay. So those isoneutrinos, they have no Dirac couplings, as I just said. Right. So there's a 0 in their mass matrix, all right, to these guys with the left. Now there's a, we do have, this is the mass term we identified right at the beginning. Okay, so that's this thing. So it has this sort of form. There are the normal Dirac couplings, which is Higgs-Vevs, and then there's this mixing piece. Okay, but there is no way to populate any of these. If there were diagonal entries, we would have found them right at the beginning. That was the whole point. When does something couple to itself? It didn't exist. And there were no Dirac couplings here. So this matrix has 0 determinant. So it's exactly massless species of fields here. The seesaw is working, but it's splitting the heavy states, not the light states that we want. So we believe, because we didn't calculate far enough out, that all the selection rules allow one of these terms up in here at degree 12. It wouldn't provide a reasonable neutrino mass, but we think that there's a way to break this log jam. Okay, so, but at least to the extent that we looked at, we'd have to say that at this point we conclude no viable seesaw mechanism. So we've just looked at literally every model in this class that's so promising, and none of them had a seesaw mechanism, despite the fact that it seems so plausible. So I want to mention the fact that we did look at spires, so we could say what other people have done. And at least on the heterotic side, I want to point out 2 very, very good attempts to do what we were just describing. Okay. So one was by Alon Faranji and his collaborators over the course of time. This is a free fermionic model. Okay, so it has sort of an SO10 basis to it. It also has an extended neutrino sector, not unlike what we had. So there are two species of fields. So we had those right-hand neutrinos and some isoneutrinos. Here, too, there were such things. This coupling that we had directly found through looking at very high-order couplings had to be postulated by assuming some things might get BEVs through hidden sector dynamics. Okay, not unreasonable, but not something you can necessarily calculate. And that fulcrum, that all-important mass term that we couldn't find, also had to come from some very low-scale U1 prime breaking that was postulated to be just the right size to get everything right. Again, not impossible, but certainly something that didn't fall out, and it certainly wasn't the minimal seesaw. John Ellis and his collaborators also have a model. It's also free fermionic. It's a flipped SU5 model. It turns out that this could very well be a minimal seesaw in the sense it doesn't have any isoneutrinos. But again, you need to choose strong dynamics to occur in particular directions so that you can fill out that matrix. So here, the only dynamics we had to assume was that these fields got BEVs to cancel the Phi Heliopolis term. So not really strong dynamics, merely just that the Phi Heliopolis term does indeed get canceled. But in these models, you had to do a little bit more. So this is it. I mean, this is the only explicit example. It's plenty of string-inspired. And in the open string picture, people have done some top-down work, too. But I'm just here talking about heterotic. So what I want to point out is different is that in both of these two cases, okay, there was flat directions being studied. That's super critical. But in both cases, what was done was the focus was on the quark sector. So you choose a flat direction, so you get a big top quark mass. And then you study that for a while, and then you say, oh, hey, you know, what about neutrinos? And you go, and once you get to the neutrino part, you say, wow, it's a real disaster. But maybe if I work and push, it'll work. So we thought, well, is that just an artifact of choosing quarks first? Let's put neutrinos first, and surely we'll find seesaws everywhere. And it turned out to be not the case. We took all the flat directions democratically, and we just kept looking for the seesaw. And in the end, we didn't even just look for the minimal seesaw. We just looked for seesaws at all. Although we certainly made our first point of entry, when does something couple to itself? If we allowed for sort of mixed mass couplings, the combinatorics would be huge. So we start with minimal seesaw and follow our nose, and we still couldn't do any better. OK, so where do we turn next? What do we learn from this? So to begin with, you might say that, well, really the problem is that you guys chose a specific set of flat directions. You didn't look to high enough order. And of course, I welcome others. I should say that each one of those 20 models took us weeks to do. So it takes a lot of time to do this properly. You know, we could, of course, look for other constructions, but we stood on the shoulders of other people who had done a lot of work on this. And there are plenty of people out there who are working on orbifolds and their cousins' orientifolds who know a lot of technology. So what we need is a way to exhaustively classify, which is what we were able to do here. And that allows us to sort of take up a model and really scan all of its possibilities. Now, you know, extended seesaws may not necessarily be a problem, but it is not the basis of 90% of the phenomenological literature on neutrinos. If what string theory, and it's hard to say because we looked at one orbifold, but if string theory is saying that the seesaw, which should be ubiquitous in our most promising orbifold, isn't there, then perhaps we ought to trickle that down and start thinking about some other possibilities, like the fact that maybe neutrinos are just Dirac and their couplings occur at extremely high order. We looked out to order 10. We're actually looking at that now beyond order 10. And could it be that we could somehow create a triplet of SU2 through, say, the diagonal break-even SU2 cross SU2 and achieve the seesaw in a roundabout way, sort of a type 2 seesaw we're actually looking at that as well. That would require a little bit different embedding so we get a little bit different observable sector. But here's what I think the take home from all this is. The first thing is that for people studying anything involving vacuum expectation values, whether you're studying flavons and Froger-Nielsen or whether you're doing neutrino physics, I think the flat direction analysis is crucial. If you don't do it, the problem looks relatively simple. But you could be essentially saying something meaningless, right, if your VEVs can't possibly be turned on in a supersymmetric way. I think this is really one of the more interesting studies, and it was a complete spin-off of what we did. There's a lot of redundancy here. I mentioned these 20 different patterns. It turns out the superpotentials were the same in all 20. So it's not just the spectrum, not just the charges, not just some global quantities like the anomalous U1 Green-Schwarz counterterm coefficient. It's the actual superpotential itself. So when you are faced with a large number, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's an intractable number. Okay. So what we need to be smart and look for this. I think this is important too. What we would like someday is to find a construction in which we could say, there's a reason that this theory wants to have small neutrino masses. It'd be wonderful if it wasn't just an accident. At this point, I'd be happy with an accident. But we don't even have that. That would be that kind of theory, the theory that wants to overwhelmingly, whether you want to prove that histogrammatically, statistically, or whether you want to prove that through brute force, the kind of theory that wants to have light neutrino masses is a theory that we should spend a little bit more time thinking about on average. So I want to point out that this, which is a promising construction, or if we had stopped early on and not pushed it further, we would realize that actually what we thought was working doesn't. So it's very important to not just truncate your theory at the 7 fields you think are interesting and say all other exotics are gone. If you have a mechanism, that's wonderful. We didn't, so we took it seriously, and we found that it resulted in zeros appearing, okay, robust zeros, as it turned out. But here's the ultimate conclusion in my mind. That is that what we did, whether or not you're interested in neutrinos, or heterodic strings, or orbifolds for that matter, the point is that this is sort of an idea of what you can do in the future, and I think many people are, I hope, which is to say, if you go in to one of these sort of thought questions, these, I will say the word landscape, what kind of ideas, this is not the same landscape, but anyway, if you go in and want to ask yourself broad questions about classes and models, let me put it that way, you can do that and you can make meaningful statements, but it's so crucial to have a concrete question that is a good handle. And I think that the great thing about neutrinos is that they are exactly that handle in a way that, say, the large top quark mass or even the standard model gauge group hasn't been in the past. So I hope that more work in this direction will follow. So thank you for listening to me.
Yeah, Ignatius.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, actually, I actually had more references, and that was for the hour version talk, but. Well, we'll definitely take a look. I think for in this case, a priori you would think that you have a lot of freedom. It turned out that we did not, and again, we don't know whether that's just the artifact of Z3. I don't think it is, but I'll take a look. And I have to do that. Okay, well, I would say that even in what we're doing, if we wanted to try to spin this a little bit more positive, we could in fact say that if we were willing to take those BEVs, remember we tied them to the anomalous U1 scale because we had hoped that that would give us something to hang our hat on. If we had let them be free, or even say that even within that sort of paradigm, there could be orders of magnitude differences in BEVs, we might actually now here we had some pretty robust zeros, but we might actually be able to fit. Sometimes we stopped because we said those masses will never be the right size. We could have probably fit, but I suspect that what you're describing maybe had more flexibility than this. This was pretty constrained.
Bobby?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. But I mean. Well, I mean, in some sense, that operator is what we were looking for. We had the restriction of the Planck scale, string scale, Planck scale being the same, because we're doing weakly coupled heterotic. And there are models that looked into that. But I have to say, again, on the concrete models, and I didn't mention some of the open string models we looked at that were concrete and talked about neutrino masses, they did not achieve a seesaw in the end. It was most of the, well, in one case, there was a potential for a seesaw, but it involved the QCD scale. It could be, but that's a sort of a different kind of seesaw. In the other case, they were definitely Dirac. They had to be Dirac particles. So I encourage open string model builders to work on precisely this question. It'd be great.
Yeah, Mike.
It's the latter, symmetry and selection rules. Well, of course, I agree, and I'm working with this because I can compute these numbers now. And I agree that in all the classes where we can do this kind of calculation as concretely as I described, we should do it, and then we can. Here, I can't extrapolate from zero very well. Yeah, I agree, but I think the problem. But to some extent, the problem, at least in the neutrino community, is exactly the opposite. It is that rather that assumptions are made far too often, that at least from up until very recently, based on assumptions that didn't seem to come out of string theory, like there's a 210 representation floating around of SO10, it's going to do the job for you. And so in some sense, it is nice to say, well, here's a concrete example, and it didn't have those properties. And in fact, well, actually didn't have the seesaw at all. So our audience was both the string theorists to say that this is not hopelessly pedestrian, this is something worth doing, but also to the neutrino community. just to say, here's the simplest thing you could have ever done. I mean, surprising no one did it before. But I would also follow that up by saying that there are a lot of models of neutrino masses that have varying degrees of string motivation. We didn't think the world needed another one of those. Actually, we may build a few, but you know.
Okay, one last question by Axel.
The first answer is no, we didn't look at that. We thought about it for a while, things like that. And number one was that we wanted to avoid those kinds of issues, because in today's environment, that's a huge red flag when you start talking about moduli. You have to really, I mean, we would rather work in a regime where nobody's going to quibble with the, it's very clear what we did. And everything was weakly coupled, and it's very simple. Secondly, I would say that we could have studied that regime, not the strong coupling in, that you're describing, but we could have put our neutrinos in sectors that were, say, getting strongly coupled. Remember that one model? That was exactly the property. And after a while, we said, well, you know, at some point, we want to compute something. It's not clear how to do that. And some of those models I described that were done in the past had the same sorts of situations. But no, we did not consider that example.
OK, then we should thank Bernd again for his nice talk.
Sure. And
I think we'll resume at 5 o'clock, no, for the LHC session.